Good morning. It's good to see so many of you here. We have a little bit of an interesting arrangement, so if you feel more comfortable, the tables up here are great for sitting and spreading your stuff out. Otherwise, we do have chairs in the back, but I'd suggest that you sit closer as opposed to way in the back on this one. I'd like to welcome you all today. This symposium is actually a kind of preview for an upcoming CSSA publication. And to make sure I get it right, it's titled Yield Gains in Major U.S. Field Crops, Contributing Factors and Future Prospects. And this is one that's been a long time in the planning, but the writing process has gone relatively quickly. And today you'll get to hear some of the sort of previews from a number of the authors of chapters in this book. And with any luck, you'll be able to purchase the book sometime in 2014. Now I'm going to turn over the program to our presider, John Shanahan, and look forward to having an interesting morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. I'm going to move this back here. So a couple of other comments beyond what Jody mentioned. I'm pinch hitting for Jim Gaffney, who with Jody put this symposium together. So I'm an agronomist with DuPont Pioneer, so I hope that I represent what the organizers were trying to put together with this session. So just a couple of other things to mention is that this session is also being live webcast. So I just want to remind all the speakers that that if there's a question from the audience here in the room, make sure you repeat the question so that our folks online can hear what the question was. So then the other thing, I guess I'm the taskmaster in terms of timekeeping, so I'll be sitting up here at the podium and just give you maybe a 5 minute. So we've got 20 minutes for each presenter. So I'll just give you a heads up that, you know, 5 minutes is you're closing in on 5 minutes towards the end. Leave maybe just a couple of second minutes or so for questions and whatnot. So the other thing is that we've got the CEU sheet that should be starting to circulate around here. So if you guys are needing CEUs, why for sure sign up on that sheet. And I guess with that, I'll just go ahead and start here. I think maybe one more comment. I think we've got an outstanding slate of speakers here that are from all the various crops across the world. And so I think we've got an outstanding program, and I think we're looking forward to all the speakers. So I'll start off by introducing the first presentation. It's by Stephen Smith from DuPont Pioneer. And Stephen's got a list of co-authors there, and I'm going to let him recognize those co-authors. And we're going to say that the title of this is Contributions to Yield of Maize in the U.S. Corn Belt from 1930 to 2011. So, Stephen.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I'd like to recognize my co-authors, Mark Cooper, Joe Gogarty, Carlos Leffler, Delos Borchardering, Kevin Wright. And good morning, everybody. Thank you. So if we look at maize yields, corn acreage and production in the 20th century and going back to the 19th century to 1860, there's three phases. The first phase you can see in red on the top as harvested area increased. And you can see during that period, 1860 to 1930, yields barely improved. So the main contribution to increased maize production in the U.S. in that period was taking more land into cultivation. From the 1930s on till about 1980, you can see that corn production increased, but the area under cultivation decreased, and that was because of increased yields. And then the third phase, from 1980 onwards, you can see a returning back to increased land area being cultivated to maize. So what's been happening, say, from 1980? That several things have been changing from 1980 till now. So this is the corn for grain yield per harvested acre by county in 1979. Now compare it to 2011. And you can see that there's more yield in the central corn belt, and there's a spread west in production and to the far west. excuse me when I get my notes in order here. But what is contributing to the increased production? You can see the corn yield trends going up, but is this due to fertilizer? Is it due to genetics, agronomic practices, insect control, weed control, weather? There's lots of potential items that could be leading to increased yields. Now, you all know that yield is genetic gain plus environmental effects and their interactions. And agronomic practices have changed in the last 30 years. The amount of nitrogen put onto Iowa maize fields was 50 kilograms per hectare in the 60s. It's now up to 160 kilograms per hectare. The tillage conditions have changed dramatically. No-till in 1989 was 7%. Now it's 21% in 2008. There's an improved knowledge and application of genotype by environment interactions, GPS linking of database of the field, the environment effects, and hybrid performance. That drives farmers' choice of buying hybrids, the genetic portion, and the planting densities they use and the nutrients they put in the field. And these can change through the field. The planting densities have gradually increased during the last several decades, and planting dates have become earlier. So, what's the effect of weather, if any? Labelle and Asner estimated that 20% of increased maize yields was due to weather. That's a pretty high estimate. What we did here was take U.S. Yield data, this is the bottom portion, and we used an N-class genotype by environment maize physiology equation to adjust the yields based on rain and temperature. So we're looking at drought-induced effects. I won't go into the details of how this is all done, but basically the slope of the adjusted yield is just, the slope of the actual yield is just fractionally from 1950 till 2011, is just fractionally better than the adjusted yield. And what that says is that the average weather effects are having about a positive effect of 1.9 kilograms per hectare per year. But when we factored in 2012, that positive effect of weather just disappeared. So this approach is telling us that the weather effects from 1950 through to 2011, 2012 are having very minimal effect on maize productivity in the U.S. Now, we've talked about changes on the farm. There's been a lot of changes in breeding. There's a lot more precision phenotyping than there was before. There is ultra-high throughput cost-effective genotyping. There's a lot more improved equipment in breeding nurseries, information management, databasing, improved statistical analyses, genome-wide association mapping, inbred development using doubled haploids, which makes inbreds quicker with more precise information on their genetic effects, more use of off-season nurseries with really comprehensive breeding facilities at those nurseries, not just to get two seasons per year, but to really have all the molecular markers support there as well. There's much more effective insect and herbicide resistance than there was back when Don gave his talk back in the early 1980s, Don Dubik. And the goals of all of this are to increase the heritability of traits, to improve the rate of genetic gain following selection. One big change has been the use of GMOs, single gene BT traits, to control insects. Here we have the distribution of maize containing BT traits in 2006. The blue is more than 75% of the acreage BT corn, the red 50 to 75%, the green 25 to 50%. So a huge use of single gene trait GMOs to control insects. And obviously we all know there's also use in rootworm and for herbicide resistance, which connects with tillage changes. So how do you partition contributions to yield? Well, there is several ways of measuring genetic gain. One is progress evaluation trials, where you measure yields of cultivars with different years of release in the same environment repeatedly, analyses of commercial crop data, and multi-environment trials. The progress evaluation trials are what Don Duvick has done or did do and published upon with maize. They were also called era studies or decade studies. That is what we are continuing doing at Pioneer and what I'm going to report here. So basically, you have hybrids, or in this photograph, cars or vehicles of different eras, all in the same environment, and you test their performance against each other in that same environment. So some genetic gain data from the past. In 1938, Ken Fry noted that hybrids had a genetic gain of 117% compared to open pollinated varieties. During the 1940s and 1950s, though, there was a concern of a yield plateau, and that is why these progress evaluation trials were initiated, for example, by Ken Russell at Iowa State and by Don Duvick at Pioneer. Ken Russell showed 63 kilograms per hectare per year increase between 1930 and 1970. Don Duvick reported from 1930 to 1980 at optimum planting density 92 kilograms per hectare per year. When the study was updated, looking through to 2001, this had gone to 77 kilograms per hectare per year. And Hagley et al. Have just reported from 67 to 2006, from low to high nitrogen conditions, a range of 56 to 86 kilograms per hectare per year. So what we're reporting here is an update of the era studies that Don Duvick began at Pioneer. We've added widely used hybrids, Pioneer hybrids in the Central Corn Belt from 2002 to 2011. So we're looking from 1930 to 2011. The selection criteria is use on farms. We've done some additional experiments measuring the effect of Cry1AB, and we're looking at genetic gain also in well-watered and drought conditions. We're also looking at on-farm yields in Iowa, which is rain-fed and irrigated in Nebraska, and we're also looking at potential yield with data from the National Corn Growers Contest winners, kindly supplied by Jim Specht. The outliers have been removed from that data. There is some controversy about whether the way wagons were unloaded or not before adding more corn. The outliers have been removed to take care of any concerns about that. So here's the rain-fed data, and we're going to look at some other slides that help get this across. So the rate of genetic gain we measured, optimum planting density, now is 92 kilograms per hectare per year. Iowa farms, they are going at a higher rate, 123 kilograms per hectare per year. So 75%, from these calculations, 75% of the rate of gain on Iowa farms is genetics. Compared to the contest winners, all tillage classes, rain-fed, at National Corn Growers Trials, the Iowa farm data is about 58% of potential yield. So that is not close to the 80-85% possible ceiling that Ken Rasmussen talked about in previous publications. When you get to irrigated, we had trials in Toluco, Chile, and Woodland, California. So that gives us a range between 81 and 96 kilograms per hectare per year in well-watered conditions. If you look at the last 15 years, it's nearly flat, okay, in well-watered conditions. That's where the 18 kilograms per hectare per year comes from. The Nebraska farm data are showing 126 kilograms per hectare per year genetic productivity gain. So that's either, depending how you look at it, 70% genetic gain or 14% if you just look at the last several years when you get a nearly flat response in our well-watered conditions. And the Pioneer era trials are about 72 to 83% of that potential yield. So that's getting close to Rasmussen's concept of a yield ceiling. We also, as I mentioned, looked at the effect of Cry1AB. We had 15 isogenic pairs of Pioneer maize hybrids at over nearly 4,000 locations in 24 states and two provinces between 2000 and 2007, and we got high corn borer infestations in four of those years. The mean advantage for plus Cry1AB hybrids compared to the isogenics without was plus 5.3%. So that's on average 565 kilograms per hectare. So here is looking at the data in a different fashion, going from the bottom to the top. We have a drought effects in woodland, genetic gain in drought, then genetic gain in drought at Baluco, and then the blue is, the light blue is rain-fed Iowa farm productivity gains, that's genetics and agronomy. And then going up from there, we have well-watered green woodland, and then we have well-watered Baluco with a fairly flat slope for 1988 till 2011. When you compare on-farm yields with the National Corn Growers Association, the bottom red is Iowa, rain-fed. Just above that is Nebraska, irrigated. And then there's a big gap. And then you have National Corn Growers, non-irrigated, rain-fed, all tillage classes. The blue, just above that, is no-till, irrigated, corn growers winners, and it's the top three, actually, the mean of the top three. And at the top, we have conventional tillage, corn growers, irrigated. Now, the question is, of course, just how much of this gap is feasible economically to be filled up. So we estimated the contributions to yields of single gene GMO traits during the single cross era, and there's many different ways you can do these calculations. As I mentioned, the positive effect of BT was 5% of the yield. We're estimating when you look at triple stacks and that the advantage with those GMOs contributes about 34% of the genetic gain, or 26% of the Iowa on-farm yield gain. Okay. But bear in mind that once, the good thing is that once you kill insect, all the insects, then you've killed them. But you have to maintain that resistance. You're not going to get any more benefit. You just have to maintain it. So if you look out over another 10, 20 year cycle, these percent contributions of the single gene resistance to insects will decrease in percentage terms. So some thoughts to help stimulate discussion. GMOs were and are a radical, innovative, comprehensive way of achieving insect control, and indeed of allowing resistance to herbicides, which has positive effects with tillage and saving fuel and conserving soil. Saving yield contributes to yield. Don Duvick, in his previous studies, noticed that using native genetics, there had been increased resistance to European corn borer, but that was far from complete. And that was attributed as genetic gain. So I do not understand why, if you use an exotic gene, it shouldn't also be counted as contributing to genetic gain. As I've said, though, once you get it, you have to keep it, and you don't add to it. You have to maintain efficacy. And so one question is just how much impact can single genes continue to have on a multigenic system, biology rules. It's fundamental to allow adaptation to weather changing agronomic practices, and that requires multigenic systems because plants, like humans, are complex biological organisms, and most of the genetic gain is coming from manipulating the native multigenic genome. So more effective uses of broader base of genetic diversity, I believe, will be important for the future. That means further development of enabling tools in breeding to drive multigenic solutions. We anticipate, looking at our pipeline, that there will be more genetic gain coming because a lot of the investments that have gone into improved breeding are still having their effect in the pipeline, and the studies that I've reported are hybrids that have come out of that pipeline. The continued further increase in genetic gain is going to be highly dependent upon resourcing. Further genetic gain might be biologically challenging to achieve under irrigation. There's a huge yield gap between farm yield and potential yield, but as I mentioned, how much of this yield gap is economic to bridge on farms and or by breeders? So it's important to learn from agronomic practices of contest winners, but what happens if and when grain prices fall? And compared to 1980 genetic gain unit, so a unit cost per unit genetic gain, we think on the back of an envelope it's about 20 times more expensive to achieve one unit of genetic gain now than it was in 1980. Here's my acknowledgements, and I thank you.